Brian spelled Handmaid's Tale, T-A-I-L. That's fantastic.
I was in a hurry. It's the porn parody. The very, very sad porn parody.
The following is a Mediocre Movie Club production.
Welcome back to the Mediocre Movie Club podcast. We are back tonight to discuss the latest series of episodes from Rome. Latest meaning the episodes that aired in 2006. Some brand ones new. That we're just not talking
brand
about.
Brand new.
Just dropped. The internet is abuzz with what Titus Lucius Verinus and Titus Pullo are up to. What happened next to those crazy characters? I'm John Kissel, and with me tonight is Shane Settner.
Yo.
Bobby Schmidt.
Hello.
And Brian Hartman.
That's me.
So, as previously stated, we are discussing the fourth, fifth, and sixth episodes of the first season of HBO's Rome, available on HBO Now and Amazon Prime. We hope you're following along with us. These episodes are entitled Stealing from Saturn, The Ram Has Touched the Wall, and Egeria. Quick thoughts about this, about these episodes, guys? Anybody that wants to jump in?
There was a lot of downtime. I feel like not a ton happened. I'm sure you'll talk me out of that, but that was my initial hot take.
You're absolutely right about the speed of the plot. Just not so much is happening. Characters are interacting with each other that previously hadn't. We're getting a lot of dinner parties, a lot of domestic type stuff.
Can I start with a geography question?
Please.
Why do they keep referring to it as Italy? Surely that wasn't a thing 2,000 years ago, right?
It absolutely was.
It was?
Yeah, Rome would have been like the center of it, and they would all call themselves... Well, the citizens of Rome would call themselves Romans, but like you live 100 miles north of Rome, you're still a Roman, but you're also an Italian. Like they did fight a lot of wars to incorporate Italians into Greater Rome instead of like Florence being vassals or what's modern day Venice just being like vassals of Rome. Eventually, you just keep spreading citizenship out further and further, and more of Italy becomes Rome. Italy is the thing. Very much so.
The word Italy was a thing.
Yeah.
I feel like Wikipedia lied to me on that one, or I just still am having a hard time finding it.
I mean, Italy is a young country, like 1860s.
I still don't necessarily.
Italy as it currently
phrase
exists.
Italy as like the area? I don't think so. That doesn't make sense.
Your intense doubt is making me doubt myself. So it's possible I'm wrong, but I'm pretty sure.
Who's our fan, Dave? Dave's going to figure this out for
sure.
Us.
Sure.
Okay.
Yeah, thanks, our Dave. Fact checker, like a week after. We could probably figure this out, no problem, as we're speaking to each other.
I'm trying.
Yeah,
it's
let
not
Dave,
going
we'll
well.
Let Dave take care of it. Okay, fair enough. As far as breaking these three episodes down, the two factions, the Caesarians and the Optimates, the Caesarians obviously being the Caesar camp and the Optimates being the Pompeian camp, they're just going in opposite directions, like, the Caesarians start high and then low, and with the Pompeians and with the Optimates, it's vice versa.
Yeah, that was really bonkers. It was just like all of a sudden, the tides have turned, and we had no idea that was going to happen, and their ships are about to sink. It was weird.
There wasn't much that went into it happening, one moment and the other.
Well, I think over the course of these three episodes, like in the first three, we pretty much saw Caesar as being the master of every decision, making the right decisions every time. Whereas we see him make a lot of mistakes in these latest three episodes, where he spends way too much time in Rome with Servilia, and he allows Pompey et al. To get away, and he leaves Antony in charge in Rome, who really takes his time in making the decision of whether or not to stick with Caesar once his back is against the wall. And we get to see his epilepsy in the fourth episode, and how it could very easily all be taken away from Caesar if certain things were found out about him. So it goes a long way towards making him like a fallible character instead of like a king of history who just can't make a wrong step and who the fates smile down upon at every opportunity.
Yeah, there's a lot of fate stuff in these episodes. Like, it's just nonstop people making tributes and praying to random gods. I thought this even more so than last time, and you brought it up last time.
Yeah,
everyone was getting cursed. There's lots of curses.
We're going to talk about the curses. Curses come up a lot, definitely. Drilling down further into the show, getting away from like the broad.
Here we go. Hold on. I got a fact timeout. Yes, there's some map on Wikipedia from, I don't know, 20 BC, and in the top right corner it says Italian.
Yes.
So there All you right. go. You were right.
I drugged it down myself. Trust the one class of Roman history you took in college. Let that be a lesson. So drilling down further into the factions and getting into the characters, what they're up to over these three episodes. Varinus, he is also on a roller coaster. He's on an arc over these three episodes where he tries and fails to become a civilian. He casts his cloak away at the end of the third episode and tries to become a grocer, tries to become a slave trader. Slaves all die. One auspicious boy doesn't die of the bloody flux or spending probably several days in a crate with dead and decaying bodies.
So, not enough to pay a dowry, though.
Yeah. Good enough to become a pet child, as my historical companion pointed out to me while I was watching that episode. But what is Varinus's daughter's actually going to pay for this kid? Very little. So he's just a suck at this point, a money suck. Dead Slaves leaves Varinus with no options. He has to re-enter the military and receives a promotion and a bonus to go along with all that. So everything is okay as far as the financials of his house, but he has become Antony's right-hand man, and he spends a lot of time repeatedly and too much talking about how I can't believe I've sworn fealty to a guy like Antony, who is a piece of shit compared to the previous great men of the Republic, at least in his mind.
All he had to do was kill a guy, and it would have been just fine.
Yeah. Yeah. No big deal. I mean, who cares? Life is very cheap.
He's done it how many times already? Whatever.
Yeah, and I think that him refusing to be a goon is more about his dignity than it is about preserving that guy's life.
Absolutely.
Yeah, Antony has become like a real asshole these episodes. Like, that's his main thing now. It's kind of disappointing.
Yes, he's very much focused on personal power. There's no artifice to Antony. He doesn't really care about the glory of the Republic or the dignity of the 13th or really anything like that. That's all extra. And he just really cuts to cuts to the meat of the heart of the matter in any instance. Like he has a scene where he's just dictating terms to the senators that are behind and running the Senate by itself. Like, when he wants something to end, he sarcastically applauds, and he's more or less daring anyone to say no to him at sword point in the Senate, whereas we saw, like, in the pilot, in the premiere, that this used to be a rowdy, argumentative, passionate group of people, and now it's just, they may as well be asleep, because it doesn't make any difference. This is all just show. Pullo is now
named Friendly McChatterson. He is just talking up everybody in the most friendly way.
I mean, he's got money. He's so he you know, he's more social.
Yeah, he's doing
throwing
good.
It around.
Caesar knows his name. He's the private tutor of Caesar's nephew, great nephew. Things couldn't be better for Pullo right now.
Even when he like goes back in the 13th and he's marching away, sword in hand, he's just like happy-go-lucky, humming a tune to himself. It's just. He's a new man.
Even the stuff that he's dealing with in these three episodes, like, it's not his problem. He's dealing with Varinus's problems. I mean, he's solving them in his own way. He and Octavian kill the man that Niobe's brother-in-law, the man that she went to for solace while Varinus was long gone in the military.
That guy
is now floating around in the sewer. Yeah, torture works.
Definitely.
It couldn't have gone better.
It's the truth every time.
This episode would have aired in 2006. You know, it was this in 24. a lot of naked piles of Iraqis can thank those two shows.
Jesus, maybe this is how that one Republican talk guy that said he was going to get waterboarded, he just became convinced watching all these shows.
He's a big
Rome fan. No, a big famous guy on Fox. I don't know.
It sounds familiar. I feel like that's a big number of people, like talk show hosts that volunteered to be waterboarded and then immediately changed their tune. I can't believe simulated drowning wasn't a goddamn blast. Several relationships, romantic relationships, are being forged and destroyed in these three episodes. Civilian Caesar, Adia, and her graffito-tagging goons. Civilian knows also that Atia is responsible, and in combination with Caesar not breaking up with her in the most gentle of ways, she curses them both in a pretty great scene that we're going to revisit here shortly. If they weren't at odds before, like, Servilia's son is taking up arms against Caesar, but if they weren't at odds before, they're very much at odds now. And then Antony, who, as previously mentioned, he does take his time in deciding to go with Caesar. It's Atia that forces his hand. She is in his same headspace. Like, she's thinking the same thing that he is in delaying. Like, what if it goes badly for Caesar? But I think to hear it spoken is what is offensive to him. And he also leaves Atia's estate pretty aggressively. So that's the end of that.
The whole, like, relationship, political drama stuff, I'm just not that into it. I have a hard time. Like, I just want, like, old-fashioned Roman fighting. And I want more of the Senate. That was fun. But I have a hard time getting involved in the drama. Atius drama.
Sure. Like, you mean, like, the interaction of, like, the personal and the political in the sense of, like, Atia is Caesar's niece, and like it's and Antony being close to her gets him closer to Caesar, and vice versa.
Yeah,
or just any of like it, even if those relationships are drained of their political intrigue, you still wouldn't be into it.
Yeah, I'm just her storyline. Her son's storyline and her daughter's storyline that was now dead husband. Those are fascinating. The political storyline of like who is undermining who and allegiances and stuff like that, and political parties. That's boring. But like Caesar marching through, or Julius, or whoever we're going to call him. I'm not sure what we call him at this point. Caesar.
Julius, like, is his last name. Caesar is his first name.
Right. Going through like the party where he's just like floating around on air and everyone's in awe of him. Oh my gosh. That's just not exciting TV right there.
Really? Okay. We'll shift the order up here and talk about that as like a standout scene. Like that was a big part of the marketing for this show and the marketing of like HBO shows in general for this period of time. Like they would always do like mashups of all their series at like the end of the year. And I remember for 2006 and for a little while after, just that scene of Atia moving through the party and then turn around at a certain moment, the camera's like behind her, and then the camera catches her in profile. That still is, as many times as I've seen that, that's still a just such a fantastic shot. And that whole scene as well with all of the political machinations involving the auger and the social niceties where Adia is trying to get her children to be witty and entertaining. I couldn't feel more differently about that. I love all that shit.
That's fine.
The thing is,
hey, Shane. Shane's
hey,
back.
Hey guys. Hey guys. Yeah, hey crisis guys. Averted. Is it okay to say I smothered my child on air?
I mean, that's what editing is for.
Okay, great. Well, I didn't smother him on air. I did it off air, so it's a dad joke.
Sure.
All right. Yeah.
Talking about the party.
The party. I love the party. This is why I like. This is why I like this series.
You love so much. To party or the party?
I mean, I like to party. I loved it. I like to party.
Likes to rock the party.
Yeah. No, it's. That's why I like the show so much, and this is why I recommend it so much. I think most of the time you think of something like this is gonna be swords and sandals and violence only, and this show excels at really the non-violent parts because they didn't have a big enough budget for the the big battles and wars, and I like watching them. I like watching the plots being set up.
Yeah, by the verbal sparring, the stuff that's said but not said, the dancing around what a person wants, the undermining, the passive aggressive stuff. I do enjoy all that. Bobby, break the
It's 2-1.
No, yeah, it's 2-1.
I was
going to
say break the tie, but
yeah, you're still stuck.
Bobby,
pour it on how Brian is wrong.
No, Brian's wrong. It's,
yes. It's, thank God. I'm glad we added you to our
ambulator. Well, it's well-made TV. I mean, it's shot well, and it breaks everything else. Like, otherwise, you're just watching a less gratuitous version of Spartacus.
Yes, that was the comparison I had in my head. Like, Spartacus, which very much is the absolute maximum of spurting blood and sword play and practically pornographic in every scene in every imaginable way, there's very little, there's no subtlety to that show. Whereas I think Rome is really, I mean, I don't have a lot of patience for more contemporary set aristocratic type shows like period costume dramas from like the 1900s, 2000 or early 20th century, whatever, like Downton Abbey, that kind of stuff. But I think this is just far enough in the past that it has some level of complete novelty while still more or less being the exact same thing. Like, I'm sure at dinner parties in Downton Abbey, everyone is backbiting and while still being polite at the same time. Yeah, I've never seen a second of that show.
Who gives a fuck about what they're talking? Because I mean, there's like literally no life and death on their hands in Downton Abbey. But here, and I think what Rome does so well is shows the people who are just being crushed under the boot of these assholes making decisions. I don't know.
See, I'm going to disagree with that point. I don't think they show enough of the bigness or the smallness of the people who are and aren't important. Like, it's sort of, as another thing I wanted to bring up is like, the city seems very small for being Rome. Like, Rome is supposed to be this majestic place. It seems small, and it seems like these big giant figures aren't as big as they're supposed to be in my head. And the plebes are not as small and being crushed as much as I expected them to be.
Well, I think there's a basis for that. I mean, yeah, these guys are very self-important, and the victor writes history, right? No one's going to write shit about some guy who had a shop on Pissant Street in Rome. They're going to write about Julius Caesar. Just like, I don't know, to me, like...
It is also something of... Democratic is the wrong word, but the people are not powerless. The people are powerless when they bump up against people like Caesar, but... At the same time, Caesar does need them and need their approval and need their acclaim, because we see how easy it is for the people to humiliate their leaders with all the graffiti and all that stuff. Like, they're not powerless. It does matter to the people at the top what the people are saying about them.
Oh, and Pompey and the Senate even say it, like, when Caesar has the people, that's a huge part of this conflict. But whoever has the people basically has Rome for that time.
Yeah, there are unquestionably powerless people in the series, and they're slaves. Pullo is a person near the bottom, at least, like, minus his Forrest Gump traipsing through the world. In a typical situation, like, he would be near the lowest strata of society. But he is a character, and slaves are not really characters at this point.
By the way, with the graffiti, I just realized we're more powerless than the Roman citizens, because at least graffiti got of confronting their leader's infidelity got results. Our leader just banged a porn star.
Oh, we were talking about this before. She recanted. It never happened.
She recanted.
She recanted.
That is bullshit.
I know. So I could give a shit. Again. Of course, Trump is cheating, but just right. That he'll be able to point to this forever.
Again.
Yeah, fine. Graffiti, I may have done this bald-faced corruption, but maybe I didn't. Remember when everyone thought I cheated with a porn star? Whatever, here nor there.
I guess I'll go to my other point.
Another great and perfect leader, Octavian, to finish up our character our character points. Like, he's also progressing through his childhood in these three episodes, even though it doesn't seem like a lot of time is taking place. Like, he's learning to fight. He's bonding with his uncle and getting closer to him over Caesar's epilepsy. And he also pops his cherry. He gets taken to a whorehouse.
I like that you just said learning swordplay. That would work for everything. Right? All the training?
Sure.
So, good job, John.
Thank you.
He also was horrible at keeping secrets when Caesar told him not to tell anybody. And like 3 minutes later, he's telling his mom and sister, like, hey. Caesar's sick.
Yeah, Atia's fantastic.
Yeah, he is.
So good.
Moving into standout scenes, does anybody have anything they want to put their finger on?
The scene at the very end of the ships about to go down.
It was not good.
Okay.
The scenes with the boats, like, it's just we're rushed to get there, and then they're on the boats, and then, shit, we're sinking. It's just...
It kind of also looks like it was filmed in someone's bathtub.
Yeah, it really was.
There's a wider shot. You see a lot of people stacked up in there. It might have just been like a spa.
They go to the ships, like, outside of, which is really pretty bad computer imaging. It's just all dark. All right. It's like one of the cartoons that, or one of the YouTube videos that Jeff watches that kids watch.
It's just blue cardboard and sky blue cardboard. And
there's some
and
weird old
moving the two.
Yeah, and some weird old man's going, Jerry, save the ship.
You can see the man's hands as he's playing with the boats in the bathtub.
That's what. Yeah, I thought Rome would at least edit that out.
I mean, the man was paid very well. Yeah. So. I don't know. Again, for longtime listeners, I don't have a great sense of when CGI is good or bad. It'd be very bad for me to notice, and I didn't. I don't know. I didn't pick up on it. I guess it does happen quickly, as far as like things progressing very fast as that episode ends, and we'll revisit that in our next segment. How ships go down.
Like the evidently very easily with very bad timing.
Yeah,
the equivalent of the hot air balloons.
Yes,
exactly.
I think the scene is the one scene that really stands out for me that I don't see on your list here. The breakup scene. That scene with Caesar and Servilia. That scene gets me every single time because the way the actress who plays Servilia plays it.
Yes.
The joy running up.
Yes.
That Caesar is here.
So it's really childlike as she runs to the
and
door.
She, like, you just, I just, like, we've all, I think we've all been there, like, being, like, so in love with somebody and so happy they're coming over. Like,
when the dictator of Rome said we couldn't be lovers anymore.
He's texting me, he's coming over.
That killed me.
And then, and then she slaps him and he just slaps her even fucking harder back.
The way it's filmed with the lighting there, too, her eyes look completely black.
Yes. It's fantastic. She acts the shit out of that scene, and the lighting and the filmography, what is that we call that?
Cinematography.
Cinematography, there we go. Filmography's on IMDb. Put that down. I'm glad we're semi-professional podcast.
Sure. Let's go with that as a descriptor of what we do here. So I mentioned the Chief Augur earlier. I think he's the breakout character of these three episodes, even though
this is the Pat Robertson character, right?
I suppose.
Explain.
He's the religious guy who is taking bribes and really only cares about money.
That's fair. Yeah,
he's
just any televangelist.
Oh, my mom was next to Joel Osteen in Vegas yesterday or the day before. So she was like within 5 feet.
I'm sure he was one of the people standing on the corner with the "You can repent" signs and not taking his vast wealth and putting it on the tables.
Yeah, I tell you what, he wasn't doing it. Was giving any money to anyone around him.
He was not even buying an expensive bottle of water from the bums on the overpasses.
Yeah. So, but also, my mom is the first person in history who does not like Las Vegas. So,
wow, that's a shame.
I may be divorcing my own family.
I mean, Caesar's palace is there.
I told her. So. Yeah, that's it's
relevant. Relevant.
Yeah. Anyway,
so Chief Augur, televangelist type. Sadly, we're not going to see this guy again. But
he was good. Like, I like all his reactions to the bribing or gifts, however you want to call them.
He's
his
so
expressions, everything were awesome. Right. Oh, absolutely.
His mouth just hanging open when
he so well
senses what's going on. And how characters react to him, specifically Mark Antony.
Yes.
Where he is just, everyone here knows you're full of shit. Everyone also knows that we have to fucking listen to you drone on about whatever, but we don't have to enjoy it. We can treat you like garbage. We can disrespect you to your face. We can make fun of you. Maybe you get it, maybe you don't. Let's just keep agreeing to our fictions and give this hugely expensive birthday gift to your wife. And then you can move the doves in the right direction. Yes. Whatever you do. And we can all pretend everything is fine.
Were they doves or pigeons? I feel like they were pigeons.
They might have been pigeons.
Well, either way, it was funny.
You know, we started talking about early in this season about the different way, like, Varanus and Mark Antony look at the rituals and the gods.
Mm-hmm.
So we have this with the doves. It's obviously fake. Mark Antony's couldn't give any fucks less. So then we go to Varanus at the end when he becomes, when he gets his raise.
Mm-hmm.
And he walks out. And I like...
The Tribune of the Plebs ritual
that
Antony did in the
in
the second episode, where he's just like sighing and exhausted the whole time.
And so now we have Varanus coming in one of these. Well, the doves one, wasn't that one? Is it in one of these episodes where the doves fly?
It was, but
and Mark Antony didn't give.
I mean, now that you mention it, in comparison to Varanus getting inducted into the Evocati, like he treats that ritual very seriously.
Like as he walked out. I don't know. Like it kind of felt different than the way he did earlier in some of the episodes, like really into it. But now he's kind of like rewatching it last night. I was like, is he just going through the motions here? Does he really still buy this? Because he doesn't really support Mark.
He doesn't want to be committed to them. He doesn't believe in their cause. He doesn't admire them as people.
He has felt himself as a traitor when they came back to Rome and everything. So
I do think that he respects the ritual. Very much.
Do you think like he thought he was? I don't know. I just didn't think.
I did take note of the scene of him entering the temple, Varanus, in his full dress. People are looking at him. It's a long walk. Everyone's just more or less going about their business. I'm not sure exactly what I took from it, but it was something's going on there. Whether I can figure it out or not.
I think he feels.
He does look reticent. I do think there's more to it, though, than this is what it's come to. I have to go back into the military.
Well, I think you talked about his integrity before, and that's why he didn't kill the guy, but I think he still questions his own integrity with this choice, too.
Yes. Yeah. I feel like he feels like this is tarnished. And maybe he just. I don't know. It's the first time we see, like, something with Varanus maybe not respecting one of these rituals he's going through all the way. Maybe just going through the motions, like Mark Antony, like everyone else.
A ritual that is taken very seriously is Serbilia's curse ritual.
Oh, yeah. Which,
fantastic scene. This is one I would have chose, yeah.
The verbiage of it, which my historical companion to me, is taken directly from a recovered curse found in Pompeii, where Kit Harington was most recently seen. And it's a great scene. Full stop, it's a great scene. Intercut with a lot of other happenings, a lot of other goings on toward the end of the episode.
I gotta stop you right there. There is a law against saying Kit Harington in great scene within two sentences of each other.
Okay, fair enough.
Also, I think he was last seen getting thrown out of a bar for being drunk. So.
Well, if I was in Pompeii, I mean, who can blame him? Train of thought.
Completely derailed you. You broke the law. Sorry, I'm a man. I'm the officer of the court.
Again with the natural lighting and the true historical verbiage and like the nail and the passion with which Lindsay Duncan is scratching into that wax paper, not wax paper, that lead paper is what it would have actually been. I'm sure it wasn't lead paper in the scene. Probably not.
Not giving them lead props.
Depends where they film. Yeah, they actually probably filmed in like some like poorer country.
Yeah, Slovenia.
No, this is paper we use.
God damn it.
Slovenia is not Russia. Slovenia is in Eastern Europe. I thought I was safe. I thought we weren't going to have to hear your Russian accent. I thought I was far enough away.
Those are my people. I can do this accent because I'm like a lot.
Way off.
Yeah, well.
Bobby's, well, you are way off.
How'd that 23andMe come back?
You don't even know where you're from, buddy. You're from all over.
Which is Shane, is your 23andMe 46% Russian now?
I strongly doubt against that exact.
I have not done it yet, smart ass Bryans. No, actually, I don't remember what Joe said it was.
Liar.
You and Jill aren't even related. It is.
Joe's made up a
number. You don't really know my great grandpa.
Yeah, I'm a.
It could be Hungary or.
I'm 5/14 Italian.
23andMe does get that precise, I think.
Do they? Okay.
Yeah.
I mean, I did in 2010, and maybe they've advanced since then. It was just straightforward. You emigrated. Your people emigrated out of Africa into the Middle East and into Europe. you're a fucking needle in a haystack.
That doesn't sound like what they do now at all. I think they updated all that stuff. You should log in again.
Fairly regional. It was like Eastern Western Europe.
Europe.
Different. No, I think it's a big difference. The different subsets of Africa. Different subsets of Asia, so it's good. So it's not just like you're from Africa, which is a giant ass continent. I'm putting one of those curses on your basketball team soon. So since we play each other soon, 100%.
All right, bring it on.
Can you video?
I mean, we live in the same house, so you're gonna slide that lead paper into some crack in your house, and I'm sure the Furies are gonna totally know to curse me and not you. Bring it on.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, bring it on. You're the only one who lives on the first floor, so.
Are we still doing great scenes?
Yes.
or scenes?
Yes.
Can we talk about at the party, they break some stuff, and Niobe goes to sweep it up, and why doesn't her broom have a handle? I was really concerned for her that she had to get down to sweep that up.
I think people's knees were just in better shape back then.
Well, did you?
They didn't sit as much.
Did you see the street sweepers in like the last episode? Like I was just stressing them out. I'm like, you're missing all of the dirt.
They had handles on their brooms, at least, though.
Come on, guys.
I think the god of brooms will only allow other gods to be swept up with handleless brooms.
So there's probably a god of handles and then a separate
god of
brooms.
The god of dirt floors is also very particular about how close people sweeping off said dirt floors need to be when they are sweeping.
It's important to note that Brian called the party a great scene. So.
Yeah.
I said it was a scene.
The
plebeian
party
you're talking about.
Lots of parties happening in episode 4.
The party
four.
Where they broke stuff.
Sure. The bust of Janice.
Yep. There you go.
Okay. So, speaking of the Varinus's plebeian party, these 3 episodes give us a lot of just like normal glimpses at Roman life. And like the city might very well feel depopulated in this period of time in the show. I think that's justified just because everyone is concerned about a massacre breaking out at any moment's notice, and there are still soldiers walking the streets.
There's also a curfew.
But probably my favorite scene from these 3 is Verena the Younger taking an offering from like a dried grape from a shrine, depositing new grapes, and then running through the city, dodging past soldiers back to her home. It's accompanied by this string track that comes back at several instances when things are just going fine in Rome and people are living their lives. It's just really peaceful, really idyllic. It really gives you a sense of what it might have been like to be alive, far more than the big operatic power play patrician scenes do, because that is kind of unknowable. The average person, you know, if they think about who they would have been in Rome, I'm sure everyone thinks they're going to have a villa and everything's going to be fine. But come on, the average person is living down the piss cloth dyeing alley and can't stand the smell of other people anymore.
Ineffectively sweeping the streets.
Yeah, like they're the person who is, you know,
poops
leaving whatever food they can at an offering and then having their daughter bring it back to them. And it doesn't seem like a terrible life either.
Again, we mentioned last episode where I don't think anybody would want to live in medieval times. It just seems fucking awful. But I feel like I could live in Roman times as long as I wasn't a slave. That would obviously be terrible.
What if you're the slave with a giant dong?
I mean, let's talk about him. Can he speak? I don't think he can. Probably not. Do his eyes work? Can he swivel them in his head? Probably not. He's just very well disciplined. And the director, and again, cinematographer of that episode, does a great job of making sure he's in the background of every shot of this guy's brief turn in the sun. He's got a giant dick. He's got a cool tortoiseshell. His toenails are nice and cute. Of all of the millions of slaves in the Roman Empire at this period, he's probably living one of the best lives.
That's what I was thinking. Actually, I was like, it's not so bad.
Yeah.
Brian and Bobby?
A large penis is always appreciated.
Brian, Bobby, any thoughts on that?
It was a penis, so there's that. All right.
I think it was more Octavia was a lot better in the scenes than that. I mean, it was big for her character.
She's really moved along since her husband was killed. Like, she doesn't really do a lot of mourning anymore, which I think is fine and good. Things happen quick. People get over stuff quick in this show. Sometimes it's odd. Sometimes it doesn't make any sense for the characters, and sometimes it's just fine to put it behind and keep moving forward.
But I feel like here also, like, when she delivered the gift, and she kind of realized, because she's being told, like, hey, regardless of what your family and mother are doing, like, I still respect you. And, like, I guess it felt genuine. Like, she wasn't just saying that as a nicety. Like, she meant it, that Octavia is good people and she's welcome there. And I think that's something Octavia needs to learn and understand, and this is part of that.
And despite the well-endowed slave with the fancy tortoiseshell in the background, Servilia conveys dignity more than anything else. And it's hard, I'm sure, to lie to her face and treat her like a moron, right, as Atia very much is doing with all these fancy gifts like ice and wieners.
Two things that don't normally go together.
The last scene I want to mention, speaking of slaves, is just a nice little window into the patrician. Not patrician, because Pompey's not a patrician. He's an upjumped novus homo plebeian who has found himself in great power. The scene of Pompey getting news of Caesar turning down his truce, and he's like looking out into the sea and feeling very sorry for himself, while the slave that delivered the message is kneeling and waiting for the next task that he's supposed to perform. And I think here's where, Brian, you are maybe missing just that dynamic, because this guy obviously has no lines. He's treated how the characters at the top of Roman society treat slaves, meaning he's just in the background. He doesn't say anything. He doesn't really do anything. He's just a messenger. He has no will. He has no goals. He's essentially furniture. And Pompey talks about how easy it must be to be a slave.
Why are you accusing me of not liking that part?
Oh, no, I think you do. I mean, you mentioned earlier that we just don't have a sense of people being pumped on.
Oh, I like this scene. I agree with it. When we're in the city.
If the show is about slaves, then the show can't be about Caesar's problems or Pompey's problems, because if their stakes are life and death, at least they're in control of their lives, whereas slaves are very much not. Slaves serve at the whims of the people around them, and they can be murdered at a moment's notice. We mentioned torture earlier. It's the law in ancient Rome that a slave is always going to lie. So if a slave witnesses a crime, if a slave is interrogated, automatically tortured, no matter what. And then they ask the questions. They must go through horrific pain before they can be trusted with anything. So, again, it would just be really hard to care about any of the upper crust. And I think Spartacus, we mentioned Spartacus on Stars, like, that show does a great job of just showing how rotten the whole civilization is to its core. And I think this scene with Pompey is just a tiny, tiny little window into that. We're going to get more of it as the series goes on.
More than anything, it really just shows, like, how detached the upper threshold of society there is from the plebs. Like, they think they understand them, and they, you know, they want them on their side, and there's power in having them like you, but they still don't understand really much or anything about them.
Right, and then you even take a like someone who I consider one of the protagonists of the show, in Lucius Farinas, and
he's so mean to that boy.
He is so mean to that boy. Although $10 says that Brian has 100% carried one of his children like that.
I don't know, you're gonna have to remind me of what you're talking about.
He gets so mad at the kid who's got like a you know, lame leg from being locked up and dying.
Oh, yeah.
Black, but he just picks him up because he gets so impatient because how slow he's walking.
Also, names his children after old birds.
Are you accusing me of naming my children after old birds?
I am doing that.
Old birds.
Verena the older says she when she sees the surviving boy, she's like, I'm gonna name it after my pigeon that died.
Oh, I thought you were talking about me still, that I named my kids after old birds.
That was the joke.
That's a joke, yes.
It was a pretty deep cut, to be fair.
Oh, man.
Yeah. But you've definitely carried your child like that.
I don't remember. I'm going to have to find the scene while you guys...
Just are. The one-handed dad grab under your shoulder when they're being assholes.
Oh, absolutely. I usually, yeah. I call it sack of potatoes, where I throw them.
I'm glad we've had multiple instances of child abuse announced on this podcast.
I grab them and I put them over my shoulder because then they're bent at the waist and they can't, I hold their legs and they can't hit my back hard enough to really bother me. So.
Yeah, no, that's the
best. We can cover some ground. We can jog and run at that point.
That's the best. So. It's time for nap move right there. Done. And that completely depowers them of everything. Yeah. There's done. It's a great move. It's a great move.
Sack of potatoes. There you go.
Yeah. Okay. Do they have anything else about the treatment of slaves and other beings that lack will in Rome before we move on to our next segment?
Nah.
I feel like there was more there, and we got to talking about how kids are fucking assholes.
They deserve to be
manhandled.
Yeah. I mean, I think the Pompeii scene at the ocean just says all. It says it all. That's it. There's nothing else to be said.
Yeah.
I mean, just such a good scene. You don't have to have any argument back and forth. Like, if this is like a scene written by a millennial-ish movie, there's some sort of dialogue there, or some sort of argument, or it goes to a scene like where someone's arguing back and forth. But you don't need to here. It just done so well.
I mean, we mentioned last week that the morality of the show is completely non-judgmental. It exists in Roman times. We'll surely find places where this might be inaccurate, but it doesn't pull its punches as far as showing how alien and foreign that is to modernize. And this is, that scene does, I think, attempt to paint Pompey as out of touch and moronic, but I think Caesar would have probably that exact same conversation with a slave. With a low, not necessarily like Posca, his body slave, his like advisor, his Greek advisor, but a slave further down the hierarchy. So our next segment, Time Makes No Sense in Rome. The first two episodes, nothing too egregious. Everything more or less happens within a month, which is fine and good. Caesar entered Rome in January of 49, and Pompey fled Italy in March of 49. So 2 months from the end of episode 2 to the end of episode 5. However, episode 6 kind of takes place over an entire year, because major battles between Pompey and Caesar don't take place until the summer of 48. And then the rest of 49, Caesar is like solving problems in Italy, and he's not really going after Pompey until early 48. So a lot of time in between.
solving problems. I'm picturing him like...
He's crushing rebels. He's crushing Pompeians.
I'm just like thinking like Sudoku, and like he's got like...
You gotta do something when you're riding that horse.
All these crosswords saved up. I've been gone for years. Thank you for saving these up for me, Sibylla.
You gotta add in that they build... Both armies build fleets of ships. in this time period that is never shown as well.
Yeah, they went to the same makers of ships as Game of Thrones.
The Greyjoys.
Hollywood needs like a shipbuilding consultant. Obviously, this is an area of struggle.
It's a good point. I can't really think of that ever being represented on camera before. I think the one place where that's all okay is the progression of Octavian from episode 5 to episode 6, where he's just better at swordplay. It took him a year.
How was I supposed to know it was 1 year?
You're not. I mean, welcome to Rome. A lot of time is going to go by.
Like, I knew some time went by because he got better, but I didn't know if it was, like, a real good month or, like, I don't know anything about sword fighting. I don't know how much better he got. He just wasn't as bad, according to the show.
He's not as good as Arya yet, but he's good. He's getting there.
The back and forth about middling, the graveyard being full of middling swords, like, swordsmen?
Yeah.
It's fantastic.
They write so well for Octavian. He's smarter than your average, like, 14-year-old, sure, but it's, like, a somewhat believable smart just because he reads so much and he's so abreast with politics and history and everything like that. I totally buy it.
His real person was really smart.
I mean, who knows? It's unknowable. Unknowable.
Sure.
Unknowable.
What we have.
He's in charge. He gets to decide. Who really knows what any of these people were like? So, next segment, Rome is an alien civilization. Everyone is totally fine with the rumors about Octavian and Caesar. It's just like a fun nudge, nudge. Hey, this dictator of Rome was totally railing his 14-year-old nephew in a closet.
His mom was excited about it.
Yes, it's like an advantage for the family.
It wasn't just...
You're the one. You're so much better than old ass Serbilia. You fucking nailed it. We are going to pretty your ass up for the next time Caesar comes by. And like, Octavia's in the room. She changes the subject, not because this is horrific, but because Octavian's, like, blushing a little bit. He's a little embarrassed. She's like, oh, mom, leave him alone. And she's, like, supposed to be his ally in all these situations. But whatever. That's just the mores of the times. Again, the historical companion chimes up at this moment and talks about just how this is totally normal. Totally normal. Rich families would often pimp their sons out to other rich families for pederast purposes, and no one cares about homosexuality. Man. It's all a question of power. Children, in many ways, are like slaves, and that they are 100%, no matter what station they are from, supposed to do what their paterfamilias says they're supposed to do. I mean, as far as, like, open-mindedness about homosexuality, like, there are certainly degrees there as well. It's totally fine for a powerful man to have sex with other men, but it's not okay to be the bottom in that scenario. It's all a question of who's in charge in any given interaction.
What was the public views of, like, homosexuality, like, within
totally
the
fine.
Common folk.
Okay. Understanding of it, yeah. Who gives a shit? Nobody cares. I mean, for a plebeian to be with, like, a patrician, like, when you cross classes, I think...
Right, no, I get that.
It's the exact same ballpark as, like, a man-woman relationship or a marriage. Like, that is a little more difficult just because of the patrician lowering themselves into the lower class. But as far as just any, like, the masculine feminine type stuff. Not too terribly concerned about.
Why can't a heterosexual guy tell a heterosexual guy that his booty is fly?
We talked about slaves a little bit, how the society confers dignity. Slaves are essentially animals. They're essentially, or pets in Rubio, the slave boy's case. But then someone signs a document, someone frees them, and they are just, like, magically granted the same rights as anyone. Like, if a Roman citizen could totally confer citizenship onto a freed slave, and then they're essentially equal. Like, we see, like, a diverse cast in these three episodes. They don't give a shit about race or country of origin or anything like that. Probably inaccurate to say there wasn't a racism in ancient Rome.
Are you asking me to do a voice impression of the girl that Tavian
definitely brings? Not. The slave, freedman, citizen hierarchy. I just think it's so interesting. They can so concretely put people into baskets and then move people from those baskets arbitrarily.
there are rules and they're so good at following rules. That part is almost
it's such a conservative society.
Because they're so able to just say, here, this is what we all agree on. We fucking voted, and when we vote, that's it. It's the will of the people. Done.
Yeah. There are increasingly less nods to democracy and anything in relationship to it. It does exist. They do elect officers and representatives and all that stuff, but just everything is series of dictatorships in families, within patron networks, like we see with Orestes Fullman, Varinus's maybe business partner for a period of time, and just the way that he's able to operate with no one really looking, and all the way up to Caesar himself. Like, he is consolidating his power and becoming the be-all, end-all, even if he is still making all these pay-ons to how the Republic used to operate. And, yeah, just bottom-up, top-down, it's all the same shit.
Yeah, making room.
Iron will, power, through and through. So, final segment. Romans are just like us. You really recognize between Adia and Octavian, like, if Adia was a stern dad who maybe got jealous when their friend had a better quarterback son and they tried to throw footballs, like the son tried to knock a football or like a beer can off their dad's head,
like,
that kind
I
of dynamic.
Like, the way you're talking about football right now is
yeah,
like
varsity blues. I'm thinking about varsity
blues. I know
blues.
That, but the way you're describing it sounds like you've never played a sport before.
I've never thrown a ball at my dad's head to hit a beer can.
The dad was just footballing with the kid.
Sure.
Where are you going with this? This is where I'm curious.
Atia is a jock dad. Adia's a jock dad, where okay. She like wants her son to get his nose out of them books and get to play in sports, and
she does remind
and
me
chasing
a little,
skirts
of a kid we coached last year whose dad would stay a little extra for this rec league basketball and just tell his kid to be more aggressive and to do things, and it's like your kid's already like the strongest kid in the court. Just let's leave it alone. He doesn't need to throw elbows in people's faces, man. Like, obviously it comes from you in the first place.
He's not unlike the obvious stepdad that we saw at tryouts who had like a ponytail and
yeah.
Looked like a very sad man who tried to tell his kid to do something good, and just the face on that kid was essentially go fuck yourself.
Obvious stepdad with the motorcycle
obvious
jacket.
Stepdad.
And
it was a Kurt ride home.
And he definitely had the motorcycle bandana thing over his head.
It was
pretty bad.
It was badly written.
Yeah.
It was way too on the nose.
Yeah.
No one believed that scenario. It was way too obvious. The point is, Addie and Octavian have a relationship that is something like that. Just very recognizable. And then, like, the weird thing about it is just that she's his mom. And, like, obviously Octavian's dad isn't around, but she's slotted into that position, I think,
very
nicely. She
does make a reference to him.
Yes, she calls him Simple.
The dad?
Yes. And he, Octavian Senior, let's call him, he was...
Can we be more creative with that?
The elder.
His name might very well have been Octavian or Octavius. That's just the way things go.
I think I go with Octavius.
I actually think it is Octavius. But he was not quite to Attia's level, but he was a cavalryman, meaning that he had enough money to support a horse, which is significant in ancient Rome. And he like rode in the cavalry, and he died when Octavian was pretty young. He's not nobody, but I mean, we can't remember what his name is.
So I think what you're saying is, like, Atia would be like the perfect Texas mom who's with a son, right?
Sure, football. She's on Friday Night Tykes.
Yeah. Oh, for sure.
If those moms were most concerned about their sons penetrating a whore and or being penetrated by their uncle.
Sounds like Friday Night Tykes to me.
Yeah.
I've not seen it.
It's a weird show. Texas is a strange place. So another Romans are just like us. Varinus names the great leaders of the Republic, and Pullo finds himself in a jaywalking segment where he doesn't know who any of these people are.
It's fantastic.
Very sad. Just to single out some of those great leaders, Varinus mentions Cincinnatus, who is held up as the ideal Roman dictator, dictator in the Roman sense, meaning a general, typically retired, who is like appointed by the Senate to guide the Republic through especially difficult times. And they, for that brief period, are completely in charge. They are essentially dictators. But then at a certain point, they are supposed to back away, as Cincinnatus did. He was a farmer, called him up, and then he went back to his farm.
Like George Washington.
That's what, yeah, exactly. George Washington named his horse Cincinnatus. Cincinnati is obviously named after Cincinnatus. And also a great basketball drill is also named after Cincinnatus.
Yeah.
He also mentions Marius, and someone mentioned Sulla as well in an earlier episode. Marius and Sulla were the Caesar and Pompey of their day. Marius was like a military genius who revolutionized the Roman army. This all took place like 50 years before the events of the show Rome. And they were very much at each other's throats. Sulla represented the Optimates, people like Cato, and he annihilated all the Marians, and he led a great purge of the city. But he didn't go as far as Caesar will end up going and essentially dissolving the Republic. And the last guy that Varinus mentions are the Gracchi, who were tribunes like Antony, except they took their jobs much more seriously. They aggressively went after the rich and the upper classes of the city and were eventually stabbed to death in mob violence, both of them separately. But they both became tribunes, and they both were assassinated by mob rule and thrown into the Tiber River.
My favorite part about this is Pullo not knowing Cincinnati, very similar to Cincinnati.
They never remember what the drill is called.
Just like our
it's
kids.
Crazy. I mean, it's named after a great Roman general.
Fan. Kids we coach know how to do Cincinnati correctly or remember.
They don't. They have a hard problem with lanes on a 3-2 fast break.
It's easy, kids.
Yeah, and just like going over, going three under the person two. With the ball. Pass.
If you
shot.
Pass right, you run right. Okay, that's
yeah,
it.
Yeah, pretty straightforward.
Dribble till someone stops you.
Maybe we do the Gracchi drill, otherwise known as a three-man weave, to start off.
What about the solo one where we just stab?
I mean, we'll see how badly I want to win this game that we're going to play against each other. Maybe we run a sullen drill, S-U-L-L-A-N, that is. And yeah, I stab your tall guys in the legs.
Which, an A, B, or C?
Why not all three?
Oh, how dare you.
Why not push it on some of your sixth graders? Make them step up. So the last thing, Romans are just like us. Gossip is used as a great equalizer against the leaders of the day. They just use graffiti instead of tabloids. I don't know, like Aziz Ansari was, I mean, not to get into that, but like his sexual exploits were just blasted all over the internet. Stormy Daniels and Trump, yeah, fine, whatever, she retracted, but that doesn't mean the piss tape may or may not be real. So, who knows? Just a way to even the scales, depuff some people who think they're very important.
It's a thing that Trump used to use National Enquirer and as all his other tabloids.
Sure, and he's good buddies with the owner of that. Right. Anything else from these three episodes?
Bobby has a line. I have a line-ish.
Quotes as usual, yeah.
I didn't write it down exactly, but the accountant for Caesar is talking about how they're running out of money, so they just go kill rich people.
And it's presented as a serious possibility.
Oh, 100% serious. Like it's
straight
been done
out
before.
Democratic playbook.
Taxation is theft.
So there you go. I thought that was amusing.
Yes,
Pasca. Learned something new.
Pasca, the slave. He occupies an interesting role in the world.
I love that.
Probably the smartest person in the room.
He had the comeback to Caesar when Caesar was like, the slaves say, or the slaves talk of bravery like fish talk of flying. And he's like, very witty of them.
Bobby, do you have a one last little tidbit?
No, I like that we see advertising from the newsreader or the whatever, the voice.
Sure, true Roman
like,
bread
this,
for true
this month. Public bread, yeah, provided by the Brotherhood of Millers or whatever. Yeah, it was good.
Yeah, he's the best.
He's given, I think, the most time to shine in these three episodes just because he's speaking to no one, and he obviously has a sense
empty
of
floor.
How stupid his job is.
The last very one, he just kind of walks off.
Yeah.
He's so good.
The dismissive way he drops his cue cards to his assistants. They do an exceptional job with casting doughy old men the silly roles in the show between that guy and the Augur. They're really, whoever's doing their casting has a flair for jowls because they're both nailing it. We'll be back shortly within the next 2-3 weeks to talk about, I don't know, what do you guys think? The next 3 episodes, the next 2 episodes as we near the
season?
There are 6 left in the season. I could see doing 2.
Do you want to do 2, 2, and 2?
I think 3 and 3.
Brian wants to do 3 and 3.
Get through it.
Let's get through it.
3 it is. All right. The next 3 episodes, I believe, entitled Pharsalus and Caesarion and Utica.
Now, those are good names because they tell me nothing about what is going to happen. I appreciate those. Those are great.
Wait, did you know what stealing from Saturn meant?
No.
Yeah, it was like stealing a car stereo, I would imagine.
Oh, yeah, or the ram touched the wall. Oh, that's like when my stepmom got in a DUI and ran right into a wall and didn't tell me.
A lot of car jokes. A lot of car jokes in this little bit that we're doing.
The best
my Kia Egeria is a reliable automobile. So, 3 episodes. In the meantime, check us out at MuticMovie.club. Like us on Facebook at Mutica Movie Club. Follow us on Twitter at Mutica Movical. Click on our Amazon link and shop as normally on Amazon, and it helps us. And reviews on iTunes help us reach more people who, in turn, may very well click on our Amazon link and help us at this trying time in the Mutica Movie Club when our finances may or may not be not in danger, I wouldn't say. I don't know. CFO, or if you had to put an adjective on it, what would it be?
We're meddling along. We're not muddling. Muddling. We don't need to kill any rich people yet. So we've got
okay. we'll see how this computer
helps with that computer, right?
Any rich people listening, I would love it if you committed a crime and hired me. I'll put some of the money right back into it.
And you will 100% kill an Indian person if you're asked to.
What?
I don't like that piece of shit Varinus. Welching asshole.
Yeah.
Just when you call Shane, use promo code Mediocre Move with Cole.
If you were to visit our site at MuticMovie.club, you would find a lot of fun podcast episodes, most recently about best movies and TV from 2017. You would be able to read some reviews for movies like Megan Levy and It and Mother in the immediate future. Probably be posting something about that tonight.
Watching Megan Levy.
Our next movie.
Yeah. From Shane, let's talk more about Megan Levy. Yeah.
The first movie in our next trio, Women in Men's Worlds movies, as Whiskey Tango Foxtrot. I'll be posting a review of that shortly as well. Thank you for joining me tonight, guys.
Thanks, John.
See ya.
Have a good night.